From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. This year's legislative session saw two constitutional amendments sent to lawmakers. Voters supported both of them overwhelmingly at more than 70% in favor. They were on solar power and medical marijuana. We also saw a flurry of gun laws proposed, including concealed carry on college campuses and in airports. There was a bill aimed at managing water flow into the Everglades from Lake Okeechobee and a bill to remove a wall between grocery and liquor stores. And now that the legislative session is over, we'll look at each of these bills to see which ones won, which ones lost, and which bills are still to be determined. We'll also talk with the author of a report on the status of children in Florida. The data came out in January, ranking the quality of life for Florida's children towards the bottom of the country. 6 months later, we'll have a look at what Florida lawmakers have done or haven't done to improve the lives of our children. First, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. The legislative session has come to a close, but there are already calls for a special session to wrap up at least one piece of unfinished business, drafting the law that implements the medical marijuana amendment voters overwhelmingly approved last year. Aside from that one piece of unfinished business, legislators finished their drafting, debating, and voting on a number of other topics. And here to go over some of the bigger issues of the year are the same people with whom we launched this legislative session. We have political scientist and FGCU Professor Peter Bergerson in the studio today. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
And we also have WGCU reporter and legislative specialist John Davis. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking about this year's legislative session in Tallahassee. Do you have a question or a comment? Give us a call or find us on social media. You can call us at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So first, let's get to what must have been the elephant in the legislative chamber, the medical marijuana bill. That came up from a constitutional amendment, which was passed by popular vote by more than 70% of ballots. The Senate put forward a pretty streamlined bill. The House's Representative Ray Rodriguez from Estero put forward a different bill with a number of limitations and restrictions that medical marijuana advocates took issue with. So, John, what happened with that bill?
As you said, that one obviously didn't pass. And there were several points of contention here as far as what the impasse was. One of those had to do with whether or not to allow smoking, vaping, or edibles, you know, with THC in them. And Ray Rodriguez had contended that was not something that should be allowed. And then you had, folks on the other side of the aisle, namely, I think, Carlos Guillermo Smith, a state lawmaker from the Orlando area, who was very much a vocal supporter of allowing the smoking. Ray Rodriguez was, his point was basically like when you're smoking something, you're bringing in known carcinogens. It reduces lung functions. It's not really medicine. He even cited a 2013 Columbia University study showing that cannabis in pill form actually even lasts longer than smoking marijuana. So he was just kind of saying, yes, we're recognizing this as having a medicinal use, but not in that particular form.
And then there was also the debate over dispensaries, who's able to produce it and get it out into the communities and things. And there was another hang up there. So that was like on a lot of different sides. They just didn't get that hammered out.
Right, right. The House proposal would have allowed for kind of unlimited medical marijuana retail outlets, while the Senate plan wanted to put a cap on the number of retail facilities that would be covered by a single license holder. So again, that was another huge – that might have been a bigger sticking point. Actually,
at the very tail end of it.
Mm-hmm.
So now, House Speaker Richard Corcoran is calling for a special legislative session just to take up this single issue. Is that normal?
For a single issue, particularly something as controversial as medical marijuana, yes. Special sessions in general for specific issues, not so much. I think to look forward to the special session, particularly on medical marijuana. I think part of it is you'd have to look at the governor, and that was one of the things that was missing, I think, in this whole mix of the debate and discussion. And you also saw an urban-rural split on the legislators over the issue of medical marijuana and an internal split within the majority party. So there was a lot of internal politics here that I think blocked the process of getting it adopted. I don't foresee a special session dealing with this at all.
Yeah, it's been called for, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen.
Now, if we don't have a special session on this, the legislature has asked the State Department of Health to actually come up with an implementation plan for Amendment 2. And they would need to do that by July. And, you know, legislative experts who, you know, I've heard from say that, you know, if that does end up happening, they don't see any way that this wouldn't end up in the court. So this is just going to play out even longer if that's the case.
And there's been a pledge by a well-known attorney to take it to court. Already.
Yes, yes. He said that during the session. That was Attorney John Morgan. I think anybody who's lived in Florida
for any length of time has seen him.
And a huge rift between him and Ben Pallera, who has been, you know, the front man for United for Care, the group that for years now has been, you know, trying to get legalized medical marijuana through the legislature in some form.
And that relationship ended up degenerating into a Twitter feud.
It got pretty ugly. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're going to see that this is good. If they don't pass it or do some action, this is going to be a really hot topic in next year's election.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that's probably going to come up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Another amendment that voters sent to the legislature with more than 70% of the vote is the solar amendment, which exempted commercial properties from additional property taxes based on new installations of solar equipment. Now, this is another bill that the Senate drafted, a pretty much streamlined amendment as written. Written pretty much as it was voted on by the public. And then, again, we have Estero's Representative Ray Rodriguez, who added to that amendment a number of stipulations in the House version of the bill. And those stipulations were directed more at solar companies selling to private homeowners. That House version included things like disclosure of cost saving and forecasting potential electric rates several years out. And those are requirements that the solar industry said were nearly impossible to meet. So, John, how did that bill turn out?
Well, you know, a version of that did end up passing, but we did not see a lot of the regulatory provisions that Ray Rodriguez's House bill would have put into place. And those were heavily criticized. People, you know, said they found them confusing. Folks working in the solar industry and the solar installation industry would not necessarily be able to keep up with them, to implement them. Representative Rodriguez was unapologetic about it. He said, you know, solar industry backers knew that he was going to be pursuing this type of regulatory framework that much like what has recently been adopted in Arizona.
Yeah, it was very much modeled after Arizona. And when we were doing this story, we did a show on this a while back, and it turns out that Rodriguez revealed at some point that parts of that drafting of the bill were actually penned in the words suggested by Florida Power and Light. Now, Peter, is that unusual for Florida Power and Light to be that involved in drafting legislation?
Well, not in Florida, it's not. And generally speaking, not around the country. The for-profit power companies are very active politically. And this appears to me as what is often referred to in legislative politics as kind of poison pill amendments. And these poison pill amendments are designed to either slow down or block or prevent particular pieces of legislation that may be popular in a broader general sense, but having these different provisions added to it ends up losing out. But no, power companies nationwide are very, very active in lobbying not only their state legislatures but also the U.S. Congress.
Do you think voters understand how intertwined they are with the lawmaking process?
Probably not at the state level. They may be somewhat familiar at the national level, but no, I would guess that the average citizen probably could not identify who their state legislators are.
Yeah. One of the bigger projects that was being tackled this year was the plan to stop green slime in the Caloosahatchee and other places from runoff out of Lake Okeechobee. The bill started at several billion dollars, and it sought to buy land from private landowners south of Lake Okeechobee to build a giant reservoir for Lake O overflow, where it would then be filtered and sent out into the Everglades. That bill met with some stiff opposition and a lot of organization from people in the communities in the area south of Lake Okeechobee. John, what ended up happening with that bill?
Well, that was really a pet project of Senate President Joe Negron. So he's very thrilled to see that that did, in fact, pass. We did get that through, but there were some changes to what had initially been proposed. Namely, I think those changes take into account folks who live in the largely agricultural area, south of the lake in Glades County. So they've kind of thrown a bone to those folks with some, you know, economic incentive programs for that region. And beyond that, you know, they were looking to do this on private land, to purchase some private agricultural land. Now that's no longer part of the plan. Now that's going to be done on public land.
So they're going to have these reservoirs now on public land.
Right.
And that makes the people that live in these communities happy because they now feel that agricultural businesses are not being pushed out or their land is not being bought, and then that business is going to go away.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. We talked to some Hendry County commissioners when this was going through, and they were really concerned about it. And in the middle of session, it didn't seem like it was probably going to get anywhere. Because it was a really ambitious bill.
Well, and Governor Rick Scott wasn't necessarily supporting it either. I think primarily because he didn't like the idea of the state bonding up to $800 million to do it, which did end up passing what went through in the end did include that bonding of the $800 million.
Well, it ends up being one of these weird things, and I don't know if anybody remembers this word, but compromise. That kind of sounds like that's what happened on this bill. Peter, do you hear about this much anymore?
Not a lot, that's for sure. The nature of politics today is that everyone moves to their particular corner and then lobs of insults by way of electronic media back and forth. This is an indication here of the legislator's personal project of wanting to defend his home turf and bring back $800 million to basically his district, and in turn was able to work out a compromise. We'll see what the details are when it works out, and we'll see how that what unfolds. This will be a great case study of legislation as well as compromise.
While we're on the topic of compromise related to this bill, it should also be noted that this is really based on the federal government coming up with half the cost of building this reservoir. I know that U.S. Congressman Brian Mast was either to unveil – either he's already done it or he's going to do it later today, but a bill that would actually provide that federal funding
Up the Florida thing.
Correct, correct. Mm-hmm. But he's doing this through additional money to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump's budget proposal includes a $1 billion cut to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. So it's interesting to see where that's going to go. Also, just this week, I know Francis Rooney, our congressman here in Fort Myers, District 19, had invited down the U.S. House Majority Leader, and they took a helicopter flight over Lake Okeechobee in the Everglades area. And he had stated after that, this was just on Tuesday, that he saw areas where money for specific Everglades restoration projects could get through the federal government. And particularly, he was looking at a bill that President Trump has voiced support for, that money for Everglades restoration projects could be tucked into. And I have to look into that a little bit more, because this federal bill primarily deals with infrastructure, roadway, bridges, things along those lines. So it looks like the federal money will likely be coming, but in what form and when
and
remains
through
to
who?
Be seen. Yes, exactly.
It's interesting because when we did a show about this a couple months ago, we had Hendry County representatives in the room along with people with Everglades Restoration. Nobody really wants to see the Everglades dry up. It's just a matter of how to get there and getting all the people at the same table to agree to something.
Mm-hmm. And it's a process of the flow of the Everglades as well, and how the ecosystem and it at least the discharges from Lake Okeechobee are not only in southeast Florida but even in our area as well. This is a piece of legislation and a major project that will have a direct impact on southwest Florida and the Gulf.
Yeah, and all of Florida. Another environmental concern that went nowhere was the fracking ban.
Yes.
It was talked about a lot at the beginning of session, and then it quietly just kind of stalled out. So, Peter, what reasoning did lawmakers give for not moving forward on that?
That's hard to say. Again, my guess is that unable to resolve the conflicts of the environmental groups versus the energy and particularly the oil-oriented groups. And without going back to your earlier question, the lack of a compromise just was not there. And in a short session of 60 days, they have to move quickly. And this just wasn't an issue that was able to garner a majority vote on.
It was doing well in the Senate, but in the House it wasn't moving forward. And this is another issue, Julie, where Fort Myers' own State Representative Ray Rodriguez comes into play here. He really wanted this outright ban bill on fracking to include money for a Florida-specific study on the impacts of fracking. And the proponents of the ban who were pushing the ban said, we don't need a Florida-specific study. We know about Florida's unique geology, the limestone substrate. We also know about fracking's environmental impacts on other parts of the country, so we didn't need that. And that's really where it all stalled right there, is whether or not to have the study.
How long does a study take?
And
that would be my question. How long does a study take, and then what's going to be allowed to happen during the time period that the study is taking place?
Now, in previous legislative sessions, Representative Rodriguez had put forward a proposal that would have instituted a 2-year moratorium on fracking.
So put it on
while
hold.
That study was occurring, yes.
Okay.
So maybe 2 years, maybe less than that.
So it didn't seem like it was seen as much of a big priority for a push from a lot of people in legislature. But I think that popularly it holds a lot of water for people.
Particularly in this area, it does, sure. And particularly out in the rural areas of the state, out in the Immokalee area and even in East Naples area. That's where from our local standpoint, the fracking becomes an important issue.
Absolutely. This is one of the few areas of the state. It's, we have the Sunnyland trend here where we are in South Florida, and then you've got areas up near the Panhandle. But other than that, most of Florida isn't looking at, the potential of drilled fracking wells.
Do you think this is something that might end up going to the voters, like the medical marijuana bill and the solar amendment?
If it doesn't, I definitely think we're going to see this bill come back in the legislature. Senator Dana Young, who was the trying to champion this through the Senate, she campaigned on this. This is a big issue for her. So I would be shocked if we don't see this come back in some form.
The legislature might bring it back, and then could it become an amendment proposal?
I think that it needs a much more statewide exposure before it would be the calculation of taking it to a statewide referendum. There's an advantage and disadvantage, and the disadvantage is it could kill the idea as well. And so my guess is a follow-up on what John suggested is that they'll give it another try in the legislature.
Yeah. And even though we have another year before a session begins, I mean we just recently saw a consortium of environmental groups, including the Conservancy of Southwest Florida based here in Naples, the Natural Resources Defense Council. They lost their challenge to try and stop an oil company from doing seismic testing in Big Cypress National Preserve. So presumably that's ongoing now, and they're looking for potential stores of oil and gas.
Yeah. Well, another topic, when we talked at the beginning of the legislative session, there were a number of gun laws flying around. Proponents were looking for a concealed carry on college campuses and in airports. There were also gun control measures that were put forward in the opposite direction with background checks at gun shows. How did all these shake out, Peter?
Well, if you take the NRA's position, they're very upset. You go to their website and you'll find that they were extremely upset, and even using language that we can't repeat here on the air. But they did get what they thought was a small morsel thrown to them. They did lose out, as you suggested, on guns on campuses and guns in airports. But they got a small, what they see is, I guess, a small bone thrown their way. And that was that there was a change in the legislation that transferred the burden of proof and in essence defended the stand your ground and made lawmakers approve a plan that put the burden of proof on the defense as opposed to the person who had a gun that might have been used in shooting someone. So they were very upset with most of the work of the legislature, the NRA was, but they did get this small, a very small issue about burden of proof.
Do you think, John, that some of the current events might have impacted the willingness of the legislature to talk about, you know, concealed carry in airports? I mean, we had a shooting at the Fort Lauderdale airport.
Is that what you're referring to? Yes, I think that definitely.
You know
had
that,
an
and then you
impact.
Had the Pulse incident, and more guns might not be insanely popular with people. I mean, not a lot of people may want to talk about that in a favorable way.
Despite those incidents, though, and those got, you know, media coverage not just in Florida but around the nation. But if you're looking specifically at the Florida constituency, you have to remember this is a state with the largest number of concealed carry permit holders in the nation. So there's a lot of support for these kind of bills.
Well, there was a lot of support saying that you would be able to defend yourself, the good
yes.
guy at the right place at the right time.
I thought it was interesting that Senator Greg Stube, who's, you know, another member of Southwest Florida's legislative delegation, had proposed a lot of these measures sort of in a single bill and then sort of switched his strategy to put them into sort of single issue bills, thinking there'd be more – a greater likelihood of something passing if you just make it one issue. And, you know, I think his strategy was certainly in the right place, but it obviously did not work this session.
Yeah, he ended up – and I can't believe the NRA degenerated to using some curse words on its homepage.
Well, it's there. I saw
They were pretty frustrated.
Yeah, they're very much so. And again – The nature of the politics here, going back to a previous comment, was that the rural legislators really saw this as something that they really saw as important, and the urban legislators, again, they stopped it. And the NRA feels very emboldened right now, frankly, and they thought this was something that particularly on college campuses, this was something they thought they were going to get through the legislature.
And another thing that we talked about when the session began was the budget and the clamorous cries to slash the budget to Enterprise Florida and the Tourism Council. So, Peter, take me back to why these issues came up in the first place.
Well, they came up in the first place because they were the part of the governor's proposal, particularly Enterprise Florida and the tourism efforts for Florida. One of the things, at least in relationship to the budget, that who seemed to be one of the losers here was the governor.
Absolutely.
And the governor really – those were – and in fact, he went to the point of campaigning around the state for Florida Forever, for instance, his idea of trying to improve the tourism trade in Florida, and these two legislative proposals were roundly defeated, or at least cast off by the governor, by the legislature, and so I would have to say that one of the big losers here in the legislature was the governor. You know, he came to the legislature as an outsider. And it looks like after this session, he's leaving as an outsider.
John, did you see the same?
I mean, the numbers really just speak for themselves. You know, Governor Scott had called for, you know, increases in spending for, you know, our tourism marketing arm Visit Florida and for Enterprise Florida. And instead, we saw Enterprise Florida's business incentive fundings just zeroed out entirely. Visit Florida's budget was reduced from $76 million to $25 million. So I think the legislature was really sending him a strong message there. And the governor, you were talking earlier, Peter, about a statewide tour he was doing, trying to drum up support for what he wanted legislators to pass regarding funding for these two organizations. And he would call out specific lawmakers when he was in their districts, telling people, "Hey, you know, tell your representative or tell your senator to support this because we need these." Enterprise Florida creates jobs. Visit Florida promotes tourism. Tourism is, you know, of course, the economic engine. So,
yeah.
But you know, as Peter pointed out, he didn't get what he wanted, and that is interesting. I hadn't thought about him coming in as an outsider and perhaps leaving after he's term limited out next year as an outsider.
And again, there's every indication that he is interested in running for the U.S. Senate, and these would be two of his prime legislative projects that he would use as a candidate and the incumbent governor as what he's been able to do here in Florida, that he would carry those through in Washington. And so it left open.
I don't want to get too off topic, but just kind of a sidebar on that issue about whether or not the governor will run for the Senate. He hasn't formally announced whether he would or not, but he did tell reporters yesterday he's going to be chairman of a new Republican super PAC, and that this is going to be really focused on promoting ideas like school choice and really kind of aggressive deregulation and really trying to not so much appeal to the establishment of the party, but to appeal to swing voters, particularly millennials, Hispanic voters. And some have speculated that this might be some sort of indication that he's trying to put himself into a better position to take on Senator Nelson. But again, his advisors have publicly stated that's not the case. He hasn't made a decision yet. So we're still in kind of a wait and see mode on that.
But I mean, does this point to a philosophical conflict within the Republican Party? They seem to be very business friendly, pro-business, but then calling any incentives towards business corporate welfare. And we have one Republican for it and several obviously not. Just this is straight philosophically speaking as far as the party.
Oh, of course. But it depends on, who's going to benefit and who's going to lose. It's families first, or it's a way of promoting the state as opposed to corporate welfare. So it depends on how you want to frame the issue. At least that's how I saw I see it. There's a clear philosophical agreement within the Republican Party between the goals of the governor and the goals of the legislature. And one of the things that stood out that I think leads to your question is the fact that the leaders of the legislature almost ignored the governor on almost every major issue, and starting with the budget.
So before he decides on the Senate, what happens with this budget? Now it's on his desk and he has the power to look at it. And what can he do? Can he change that budget in the budget that's been given to him? Is there any way for him to add money to his Enterprise Florida?
No. He has three options. He can sign the legislation, the budget, into law. He can line item veto some of the appropriations or all of the appropriations, but he cannot add anything to it.
And there was one budget cut that you mentioned that kind of targeted hospitals that you thought that the governor might have a keen eye to draw a line through.
Yeah, and that's $521 million cuts in the aid to the hospital, particularly for reimbursement for Medicaid and health insurance for the poor. And I noticed this week why representatives from Lee Memorial Hospital hopped on a plane and went to D.C. and lobbying there for some additional money. Hospitals not only here in Southwest Florida are going to be hurt by the Florida budget, but proposed changes in the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare are also going to have a negative impact on it. So hospitals are already scrambling for public funding. And Lee Hospital is a public hospital as opposed to other hospitals that tend to be private.
Mm-hmm. So what now happens with the governor? He has this budget. He may not be happy with it. Can he reject the whole thing?
Yes. Well, he can, but they'll have to meet and scramble. If he were to reject the whole thing, they're required to have a budget in place by the start of the fiscal year, which is July 1st. And so it appears that he is mulling over what he might do, reject it all, or some line item vetoes that he might not like. He, in the past, has almost always invoked the line item vetoes on certain issues, and subsequently, there would be a real risk if he vetoed the whole budget. But he may, and we'll have to wait and see.
If he does veto it, then the whole legislature has to come back for a special session.
Exactly.
How long do those typically last? Is there a timeline?
Yeah, there is a timeline that is set by the governor, I believe, or at least the legislature would. Well, the end of the timeline would be July 1st.
But there is pressure to, you know, move through these special session, you know, scenarios as quickly as possible.
Yeah, because they don't want to be there any longer than they have to.
They don't want to be there any longer than they have to, and it costs money. And then this is something that's really going to catch the ire of your, you know, taxpayer watchdog groups. And, you know, it's just kind of a criticism they'd prefer to avoid.
And, you know, the legislature last year couldn't agree, and they went home early mad at both chambers mad at each other. Mm-hmm. And in addition, keep in mind these legislators are citizen legislators in that almost all of them have another job. Mm-hmm. And so that would be taking time away from, you know, their quote-unquote day job. And so it really would throw the state into at least a degree of turmoil for some period of time. My guess is that they would probably only address a handful of issues, and there would have to, and the governor would try to compromise with his two pet projects that were decimated from his perspective, and add those to the budget.
Mm-hmm. And then some of the smaller issues, the taking down of the wall between grocery stores and liquor stores, that went through. John, tell me a little bit about that. Where did that law even come from in the first place?
Okay, so the liquor wall bill, I guess, there's a provision in Florida law, and this goes back to Prohibition era, where you couldn't sell, you know, liquors on the same shelf as regular grocery items. You needed a separate physical space with like some sort of wall between them. And so, you know, I think lawmakers who were in favor of this just saw this as a Prohibition era relic, something that needed to go away, and it was certainly something that a lot of business groups supported. You know, you had stores like Target and Walmart who, you know, they want to be able to sell liquor to their customers, so they want to tear down that wall. but then you've got it was odd because then you had retailers like Publix, you know, one of the largest private employers in the state of Florida that's pretty ubiquitous there around. But their physical business model for decades has been to have freestanding liquor stores that they whenever they build a new Publix, there's a liquor store right next to it. It's part of the same building,
but
you have to go through a separate entrance. So for them, they're saying, hey, you know, we followed this law. We've built our business model around it. If you change it, it's going to hurt us financially.
This was affectionately known as the Wheaties and Whiskey.
Yes, that's right.
the Wheaties and Whiskey bill.
And it also met quite a bit of opposition from the freestanding adult beverage stores like ABC,
yes,
Liquor, and Total Wine. And this is at least nationwide was really known as the Blue Laws, and almost every state has some form of odd arrangement in which they segregate the sale of alcohol, beer, and wine. And oftentimes, like here in Florida, where the alcohol was completely separate, but you can buy beer and wine at a grocery store, but just not spirits. Mm-hmm. And subsequently, this passed. And so
liquor laws have to be some of the strangest laws, you know, from county to county and city to city and state to state. It's just so
bizarre. Well, it's a
bizarre
carryover from the Prohibition period in the time of there was no legal sale of alcohol.
And those who were opposed to repealing the Prohibition-era law were putting forth arguments saying things like, well, you know, having it this way, having the liquor in a separate place prevents people from making, you know
multiple
kind of like
stops.
Well, no, I was just going to say from making those kind of quick decisions, you know, buying, you know, I don't, maybe a bottle of vodka when if you'd had to have gone into a separate store, you wouldn't have.
Like an impulse buy?
An impulse buy, yes.
Like a pack of gum or a bottle of vodka.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Obviously, that didn't.
Or the National Enquirer, which is what you get at the grocery
yes
store on the impulse buy here. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break, but we are talking with political scientist and FGCU professor Peter Bergerson in the studio today, and also WGCU reporter and legislative specialist John Davis about the latest legislative session. We're wrapping it up. We'll be back after this short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. We're talking about the Florida legislative session of 2017, which recently wrapped up. We've been covering all topics from amendments on medical marijuana and solar amendments that passed by voter approval of over 70%. We've gone through that. We've gone through a number of other things. But one thing we need to talk about now is education. Tell me, John, what is the legislative bill in the charter school?
Okay, there was a bill called Schools of Hope, and this was for K through 12 schools. And basically what it said was if you're a public school and for, you know, 3 years in a row your school receives a grade of a D or an F, the legislature is setting aside $200 million to help out high-performing charter schools to move into those areas and to compete with the public schools. And so this was something that, you know, I think public school supporters were very much against. They see this as expansion of the charter program and taking away funding from public schools. Their argument against this was, you know, why are we going to bring in – pay money to bring in a charter school instead of focusing on fixing the poor performing public school?
So help me understand. Peter, maybe you can help me understand this. What is a charter school? Isn't it a public school?
It is. It's a public school that is set up by usually some community, some organization. They file a charter, in essence, what they're going to do and what are their goals and objectives. The local school district is required to, assuming they meet the standards and the expectations that in, quote unquote, in their charter, then they're set up to run as a public school, and they get public funds for it.
So public funds that would go to public schools go to these charter schools.
That's right. And they're,
which are run by outside entities?
Some of them are – there are some organizations that outside organizations that solely are designed for this. In fact, our present Secretary of Education at the national level is – really been a major and perhaps the most significant proponent for charter schools nationwide. And some of them, private organizations, even religious organizations, have set up charter schools. They don't teach the religion, but or at least they claim they don't. And in essence, that's what their charter school is designed. Most of them tend to be, or at least a lot of them tend to be in urban areas, and you not only there, but that's where they or you find them in areas where there is a denominational fever for that in opposition to the public schools.
Mm-hmm. And so this bill then takes money and puts it towards these charter schools.
Correct.
And that, how is that going to impact public schools? Is it taking money out of the public school, robbing Peter to pay Paul?
Well, it doesn't necessarily impact what the legislature is going to appropriate for public education. But yes, it does come out of the same finite pool of money.
Yeah. So the public education people are looking at it like, why would you do that instead of focusing on what's existing?
One of the things that the Florida Association of School District Superintendents, they wrote that they were gravely concerned about the per pupil allocation, and this is where the problem of comes with charter schools and the traditional public schools is that there less money is going to go to the traditional public schools, as John suggested, as opposed to trying to improve them. They, in essence, are going to – the bad ones are going to continue keeping being bad and perhaps even get worse. And so it's going to continue that spiral. And then these charter school students supposedly are – their education is going to be enhanced or improved. A lot of the research on charter schools is very mixed at best.
Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to look further into that in the future as well. One of the things that occurred in the most recent legislative session is a dramatic personality. We had one lawmaker that stepped down towards the end of session. What happened there, John?
That was an issue with Frank Artiles. I guess there was some sort of tirade in a restaurant where he said some less than kind things to some fellow lawmakers. This was a racially motivated tirade as well.
And it was gender as well.
Oh, yes. That's right. That's right.
It was gender, racial, explosive comments that he, in essence, was forced out by his own party.
Yeah, he had initially said he was not going to resign, and he did offer an apology, but then very quickly that turned around. So that was kind of a little bit of a distraction from the work of the legislative session. But you know, there's always a little drama.
Yeah, there's a lot of drama. And then I wanted to ask also about the gambling. What happened with gambling in this last legislative session?
Again, I think that at least from a political standpoint, some of the entertainment companies in Florida, such as Disney, was able to exert their political muscle, and they saw this as an encroachment on the entertainment dollars that Floridians and outsiders might spend on Disney or related amusement parks, entertainment parks, and the money would go to gambling. The gambling interests. They did get some small advantages out of the legislature, particularly where dog races and dog tracks, like the one down here
in Bonita.
Yeah, they can expand some of their gambling. I think they can now have roulette. They cannot have slot machines, but they can have roulette and some other forms of gambling that can take place. But again, going back to the nature of the legislature and the representation of where the urban legislators wanted it and the rural legislators, as well as some of the major industries, were opposed.
Right, under a bill that legislators actually kind of did come close to passing at one point, would have, among other things, allowed 8 counties to have their own slot machines. And Lee County was one of those. This was from a voter-approved issue from several years ago. So, you know, that's something that would have had a specific impact on us here in Lee County. But again, nothing happened there. And really, the expansion of slot machines was the sticking point with that bill. But the failure of any bill passing also kind of means a loss of this guaranteed $3 billion over the next 7 years from the Seminole Tribe of Florida, and that would be in exchange for new tables. So as far as projections into the future, I think this is a lot like fracking or many of the other issues that we saw where things had been proposed but then it didn't go through. This issue is not going anywhere.
It's kind of like perennial legislation.
Yes.
These proposals that keep coming up and they just kind of don't get there. I wanted to ask, what is on average? How many things are proposed and then how many things actually pass usually? I mean, do you think about 50% of the things that are proposed pass?
Heavens no. Probably less than 10% that are proposed actually pass. And so many of the ones that are proposed and do pass are carryovers from one session to the next. I've seen the number someplace, but less than 10% of those that are going to be introduced are actually going to pass. Keep in mind, it's just a 60-day session.
Is there any possibility of them extending that session?
Well, you know, that's interesting. I think one of the things that our listeners should pay attention to is the Constitutional Revision Commission. And the Constitutional Revision Commission that's underway now, they can extend this, or they can make a proposal to extend the session, which, frankly, I think would be a good idea. But and they could extend it to whatever, you know, some particular amount of time. But 60 days and trying to run a state with an $80 billion budget and is the third largest state in the country really is a holdover from the 19th century.
In regards to our current, you know, 60-day legislative session and just simply the amount of things you can pass in that short period of time, this legislative session we just saw 211 bills pass. And just to put that in perspective, that's the fewest number of bills we've seen pass in a regular session in 20 years here in Florida.
Hmm. I wonder if the contentiousness has added to that.
That's not even as many or just about the same as when the legislature adjourned early.
And how does our legislative session at 60 days compare to other states?
You know, it varies. The smaller states, this would be in that range. But even states, you know, for instance, like Missouri, they have a six-month session. You know, some of the states, the larger states, they meet almost all year round like the U.S. Congress does. I don't know that that's necessary, but 60 days, again, is a carryover from kind of the Jacksonian period of the 1820s or so. And we'll see what the Constitutional Convention Commission comes up with as far as the excuse me, as far as the length of the session.
I was poking around on the website, the state representatives and Senate, and looking at them, and it seems like their compensation is around 30-something, sometimes 29, I think. So it is a part-time job. That's not a full-time pay in the state of Florida.
Yeah, right.
So if they did extend it into a more of a full-time job, then that would probably be –
And it would change the nature of the representation as well. In other words, I don't know that they would change the compensation right away. But what you would do is you would attract other people, other types of people who may have more time to commit to it. You know, if you paid $45,000-$50,000 a year, you'd get a totally different class of people.
Yeah, you would attract different people, definitely. And a couple of things that they did manage to pass that you talked with me earlier about, a little bit more symbolic, but a couple of apologies. Tell me about those.
Yeah, there was at least two major apologies. Maybe John can help out here as well. But one of them had to do with was it the Cleveland Four?
The Groveland Four.
Yeah, that was a major issue apology. It took an incident, really more than an incident, but I think it was in 1949, a racial incident that led to the death of four African Americans, and were found that the state legislature issued an apology for it.
I think the second apology also was that related to the Dozier School for Boys?
Oh, yes.
And that was a North Florida reform school that had operated in the past. And, you know, if it's a story – it's a story that we've been following for a number of years now as they've been finding and exhuming bodies that were buried there of, you know, young men that who'd been sent there. And I guess there were – you can actually go on – there is a website where you can read a lot of these survivors' accounts of what they went through at this school.
It was and so there's a lot of, harrowing reports.
Yes. So there's a lot of information that's been coming to light in recent years. And they've actually approved a couple of memorials as well just to recognize the victims, both living and the survivors from that school.
Yeah.
Another element – that was really horrific, the Dozier School – you know, it's almost hard to conceive of the degree of brutality that took place there. Another is the change in jury decisions that dealing with the death penalty may seem small, but at least again, for some people, important that Florida Supreme Court, in essence, made a decision that it required a unanimous jury decision to give issue a death penalty, and that is again something that they amended or changed in the legislature.
Lawmakers had to do that; kind of forced their hand to do that by the Supreme Court. I remember that story, John. You did something with that too.
And that's something that's been dragging on for a bit because there's been these fixes that have been put into place, and then the fixes have been struck down by the courts. And so I think that, you know, we talk about a lot of this legislation being sort of perennial or reoccurring. I think this might be something that sort of puts that issue to bed.
And
really puts Florida in line in terms of what it requires for capital sentencing with what most of the country already has.
Yeah. You said the only other state that kind of has the less than unanimous was Alabama.
Alabama, yeah.
Yeah.
Taxes is something else we could talk about. There were some, you know, tax reductions as well, or tax cuts, I'm sorry, approved in there, about $75 million worth, which may be significant, but it's far less than what Governor Rick Scott had called for in his proposed budget.
I think you're referring to the homestead exemption.
That's one of – well, not entirely, because that's something that we're going to have to decide in 2018.
Okay.
We do have the sales tax holidays on hurricane supplies. Hurricane season's, you know, just a few weeks away now. Also on school supplies.
That got reduced to 3 days, didn't it?
It did. It got reduced this year.
Yeah.
But the homestead exemption, yeah, they're going to put to voters in the 2018 ballot whether or not to approve a $25,000 increase in the homestead exemption for homeowners. So sounds like something property owners, homeowners would be really clamoring to vote in favor of. On the other hand, you've got local governments who are worried that, you know, this is going to mean losing tens of millions of dollars in their own coffers. So we could see budget slashing or reduced services or, you know, tax increases in some other form at the local level.
That could probably end up being tourist tax or sales tax or hotel bed use tax. Those tend to be the targets when it comes down to those local things.
One of the big winners, I think, also was the funding for state universities, which, of course, is a really close to my heart and interest, and particularly a $300 million boost in operating expenses, $121 million to increase financial aid for students, $180 million for the state's Bright Future scholarships. This will help keep some of Florida's best and brightest here in Florida. And so those are some other things that I think our listeners can be proud of the legislature enacting as well.
So now we just wait for the governor to decide what he's going to do with the budget.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's the takeaway from today is stay tuned because there's still a lot we don't know.
You know, we talked about doing this shortly after the legislative session was scheduled to end on the 5th. And you said wisely, let's just wait a little on that.
Yeah.
Let's schedule that a little
bit. We don't know that we're going to end on the 5th. Yeah.
Yeah. But, this may seem minor, but you know, the nationwide explosion of Uber and Lyft was also addressed in the legislature.
Yes.
And the state passed a uniform state regulations for the what is called the for-hire transportation services. And this sets up requirements for insurance, background screening for drivers, and the legal use of transportation devices such as Uber and Lyft.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming in and talking with me today over the legislative session 2017. We will stay tuned and we will keep everyone apprised as that budget moves forward and across the governor's desk. Thanks so much for coming in.
It was great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1. WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM. NPR for Southwest Florida.